This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
The annual HIV and STI report was released this morning at the Australasian HIV and AIDS Conference in Canberra, and looked at the growing concern of infections in Indigenous communities, especially amongst men who have sexual relationships with men.
The Informer's Ian Muchamore talked to co-convener of the conference, Associate Professor Martin Holt, about the early signs that HIV infections are dropping and the role that PrEP is playing in this.
We have on the line Associate Professor Martin Holt. Welcome to the show, Martin.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thank you.
The big report that's out today is the national picture of what the figures look like for HIV and for STIs. What does the picture look like?
Well, the overall picture is one of stability in HIV across the country, but some promise in some jurisdictions and some points of concern in others. And so the areas of promise are in some of the eastern states, particularly New South Wales, Victoria, and perhaps Queensland, where it looks like there are the beginnings of some declines in infections, particularly among gay and bisexual men. And we think some of that is to do with PrEP, the rollout of PrEP in those communities. Yep. And there are some areas of concern in terms of a small but growing number of infections in Aboriginal communities in the far north of the country.
So we're seeing a bit of a different picture in HIV in different states and territories. Is the increase that we're seeing in HIV amongst Aboriginal communities, is that in gay and bisexual men or is that in other populations?
Well, the majority of infections in Aboriginal communities are among gay and bisexual men, but Aboriginal people who get are affected by HIV, there are higher rates of transmission from sharing injecting equipment and through heterosexual transmission. But the majority of infections is still among gay and bisexual men who are Indigenous.
So this is a growing concern, is it?
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, it's been on the agenda for a few years in the sector about, I think the warning signs were raised with rates of diagnosis of syphilis in some Indigenous communities in far north Queensland. And now across the top of the country, we're seeing syphilis epidemic has spread, and now we're also seeing increases in HIV. And one of the big concerns with such an enormous geographic area and communities where there are high rates of mobility, but also poor access to healthcare and poor health service provision, is how do we successfully engage communities in a way that is culturally appropriate and supported and owned by Aboriginal communities, where we can actually get them to choose the appropriate prevention methods that they find as most appropriate for them, engage in testing, go for sexual health screening, and so on. And obviously that is a very different formula that needs to be created and supported and nurtured than engaging, say, for example, Anglo-Australian gay and bisexual men in metropolitan areas.
Which is what we often think about when we think about HIV. We think about gay and bisexual men in Melbourne and in Sydney, but we need to go broader than that. What's the picture looking like amongst heterosexuals, amongst women in particular?
Yeah, so the infections among heterosexual people still remain a minority of the epidemic, but of course they're not declining. And typically in Australia we see that, you know, people who have connections to high prevalence countries, so they might have migrated here, or partners of those people tend to be at particular risk. And then there are small numbers of other heterosexual people who may be affected by HIV. And of course, engaging heterosexual people who may be at risk is very, very challenging, in the sense that they're the majority of the population. But coming up with successful strategies that are appropriate, particularly for people, say, from culturally and linguistically diverse communities, it is challenging, where historically they have not been the majority of the epidemic. I think increasingly we will have to see ways to grow that area of response if we're actually serious about getting on an elimination pathway for gay and bisexual men and for everybody else who's affected by HIV.
So that's a little bit of a different narrative. We've seen a lot of very positive stories in some of the LGBTI media in recent months about drops in Victoria and drops in New South Wales. Is that attributable to PrEP?
Yes, so I believe it is. I think there's been amazing progress in PrEP, particularly in New South Wales and Victoria, and and also Queensland, and we're also now seeing a proliferation of access schemes, demonstration projects in some of the other states and territories. However, we should we could see from a community perspective, you know, this enormous demand for this new prevention method, which I think there are two really positive things there. It underlines how seriously people take HIV prevention, particularly gay and bisexual men who may be at risk, and that this has given a really great opportunity for the people who maybe felt that existing prevention methods didn't work for them. So that's fantastic. The problem, of course, is that we're relying on these kind of state government-sponsored demonstration projects, and they are not, you know, they're not permanent schemes, they're not permanent projects, and we are desperately waiting for a decision from the Pharmaceutical Benefits Advisory Committee about whether any of the drug manufacturers who've made submissions for Truvada or generic Truvada, the drug that's used in PrEP, whether a public subsidy will be recommended. And of course, there's fear here that some of the manufacturers have not made cost-effective submissions, and that the committee will have no choice but to say no to the submissions. And then we're left in a limbo where we are trying to work out how to actually make PrEP available throughout the health system to everybody who needs it.
So we've featured PrEP a number of times, and we've talked about the cost the drug companies will be charging. What else can community do, or what else can we do through research or through activism to make PrEP available to anyone that needs to use it?
Well, I think so. This is the question. So we're waiting, we're assuming that PBAC will make it deferred a decision on PrEP from earlier in the year. It reports next month. We shouldn't prejudge the outcome of that. It could be positive. Yep. One of the submissions made by manufacturers could be approved, in which case then it's just a question of encouraging the federal government to agree with the approval and to work out the details of how prescribing practice will be implemented, supported by Medicare. If the decision is no, I think we will need to think about a consolidated period of activism once we understand the details for the reason for the rejection. And my reading is that if the decision is no, it will largely be because the manufacturers are asking for too much money for the drug. And we know, particularly the generic manufacturers who may be involved in the process, that they can make this drug very, very cheaply. And then I think we will need some concerted action to put some pressure on them to make a resubmission at a more affordable price.
Do you think we've put that pressure as a community, as researchers, on the drug companies involved so far?
I think what we have tried, and I'm not intimately involved in this process, although I have made, on behalf of my centre, submissions to PBAC in support of PrEP for affected communities. I've been involved in some of the cost effectiveness modelling, which kind of looked at the various scenarios in which PrEP is used. I think we have largely operated in an advisory capacity to manufacturers who might have been unfamiliar with the PBAC submission process. But I think, given all the advice that has been provided in good faith, and there's been open disclosure of the cost-effectiveness modelling nationally, so anybody who wanted that modelling could access it and they could see the most likely price points that would be acceptable in the Australian context and to the government. I think if that is ignored, I think we will have to be much more critical in our stance. But let's hope I'm wrong about that. Let's hope that actually there will be a positive decision in favour.
But that's very important, I think, that we, if it doesn't happen, we might need to rethink our strategy. Martin
Indeed.
Holt, thank you so much for being on The Informer. We might chat to you later in the week and hear how the rest of the conference is going. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.